Welcome to the deep dive. This is where we take a whole stack of information, could be articles, notes, research you've gathered, and we boil it down for you. We pull out the most important, maybe surprising, and definitely the most useful insights. And today we're tackling a condition that, well, it affects millions, but it's often really misunderstood. Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. Our goal here is simple. Cut through the confusion, help you get informed quickly about what it's really all about. You know, for such a long time, ADHD's been kind of brushed off as, oh, it's a behavioral choice, maybe a character flaw, or just not trying hard enough. But this deep dive, I think, is going to reframe that completely. It shows it as a distinct neurological variation.
That's exactly right, yeah. The core idea coming through all this material is that ADHD isn't really about choice or willpower. It's more like distinct wiring, particularly in the frontal lobe. That's the bit of the brain handling, planning, focus, managing impulses, that sort of thing. It's fundamentally a lifelong neurodevelopmental condition. But what's also really interesting and often missed is how that same distinct wiring that causes challenges, it can also be a source of, well, remarkable creativity. Like, difficulty staying focused might mean hyper-focus on things someone is passionate about, or those rapid thoughts. Sometimes that fuels really innovative problem solving. Mm. So this deep dive should really shed light on how unique it is for each person. Okay, so let's unpack that a bit. Based on the material, what exactly is ADHD fundamentally? Well, at its heart, it means the brain just processes information differently compared to neurotypical people. Neurodevelopmental usually shows up in childhood, often sticks around into adulthood. And the crucial thing, it's not a choice. It comes from like actual structural differences in how the brain developed, impacting those executive functions in the frontal lobe we talked about. In fact, the research points out something like 75% of cases have a family history.
Wow, 75%.
Yeah, which points strongly to genetics. It underlines these, you know, natural variations in brain wiring. They're not flaws or failures.
That's fascinating. So the modern research showing these structural differences, it really cliques why those standard concentration tricks often just don't work for people with ADHD. It changes the whole approach, doesn't it?
It really does.
So what does this actually mean for how we should perceive and, maybe more importantly, support people with ADHD?
Well, the first thing that jumps out is just how vital awareness is. Mm-hmm. October is actually ADHD Awareness Month, and you see campaigns trying to tackle those really harmful myths, like the old idea that it's just down to bad parenting or kids not being disciplined enough, that kind of thing. And for kids especially, recognizing it early means they get timely support. That really improves things like school outcomes and social stuff, too.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And when families understand it's not about blame, it must lead to real practical benefits, like being stronger advocates in school or with doctors.
Exactly. And getting access to strategies that actually work for their way of thinking.
And maybe feeling less alone, finding community connections.
Yeah.
Reducing that stigma.
Precisely. It helps shift the view from seeing it as a deficit to seeing it as, well, cognitive diversity.
Cognitive diversity. I like that.
Yeah. And that perspective helps everywhere. Workplaces, classrooms, even relationships. It lets people actually harness their strengths instead of always fighting their own brain.
Okay. So it's not a choice. Awareness is key.
Right.
But it's also complicated because it doesn't look the same in everyone. The sources actually break it down into, what, three different types or presentations?
Yeah, three main ones. Understanding these is really important because the symptoms can be so different. First, there's the predominantly inattentive presentation.
Okay.
This is where the main struggle is with sustained focus. You know, maybe losing track during conversations, finding multi-step tasks really hard. This type actually explains a lot of undiagnosed cases, especially in girls.
Oh, interesting. Why girls specifically?
Well, their symptoms might be more subtle, like daydreaming, rather than, say, obvious physical hyperactivity, so it gets missed. You could have someone just completely zone out in a meeting, not being rude, their brain's just elsewhere, maybe solving some other problem. That's often what's happening. Then second, you have the hyperactive impulsive type.
Right. That sounds more like the classic image, maybe.
Sort of. It's marked by that physical restlessness, difficulty sitting still, and impulsive decisions, like trouble waiting your turn, blurting things out, interrupting. This one's quite noticeable in childhood, though the sources say the really overt physical stuff often becomes less common as people get older. And finally, the most common is the combined presentation.
Which is just both.
Essentially, yeah. A mix of the attention difficulties and that restless, impulsive energy. And that combo can impact, well, pretty much everything, relationships, work, you name it.
Oh.
The material also mentions that these presentation types aren't totally fixed. They can shift.
Oh, really?
Yeah, maybe during big life changes or even with hormonal shifts.
Mm.
And another key thing, that hyperactivity in adults. It often feels more like internal mental restlessness, racing thoughts, not necessarily bouncing off walls.
Okay, that's a really critical point. So knowing these variations helps you figure out what kind of support or strategies might actually work. It's not one size fits all.
Exactly. So we know it's neurological. We know it looks different ways.
Yeah.
What are the specific signs? Like the day-to-day behavior someone might notice, the sources mentioned, they usually show up before age 12.
Yeah, that's the typical guideline. For inattention symptoms, we're talking about more than just being a bit forgetful sometimes. It's things like frequently zoning out when someone's talking.
Mm-hmm.
Difficulty following through on instructions, especially if they have multiple steps. Chronic disorganization, maybe with school stuff or paying bills as an adult. And the key is, these things persist even when someone is genuinely trying hard.
Right. It's not lack of effort. Not at all. Like a kid who really struggles to finish homework even though they get the material, or an adult who keeps missing deadlines despite having planners and lists. It's a consistent pattern.
Mm.
Then for hyperactivity and impulsivity markers, that restlessness we mentioned, it really does change with age. Little kids might literally climb on furniture excessively. Teens might constantly fidget, tap pens, shake their legs.
Uh-huh.
Impulsivity shows up as like blurting out answers before the question's even finished.
Yeah.
Or intruding on other people's games or conversations. Struggling really hard with waiting in line. There's a quote from Dr. Emily Hart in the material. She says, "It's not just energy. It's feeling physically uncomfortable when required to stay still."
That really frames it differently, doesn't it? It's an internal discomfort.
Exactly. A kind of internal drive that's hard to resist.
So listening to this, maybe some of these patterns sound familiar to you. Maybe in yourself or someone you know, a child, a friend, a partner. It's about that consistency, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's say some of these signs do ring a bell. What's the next step? How does diagnosis actually happen? It sounds like it could be a bit daunting.
It can feel that way, yeah. But the material lays out a pretty standard process.
Right.
Often, for kids, the first contact might be at school. The Second Coast Special Educational Needs Coordinator might raise concerns.
Yay.
Then, if the symptoms are showing up in different places, not just school, your GP gets involved. They'll ask a lot of questions about how consistent the symptoms are, developmental history, family history, too. Remember that genetic link?
Mm-hmm.
Part of their job is also ruling out other things, like anxiety or maybe thyroid issues that can sometimes look a bit like ADHD. One pediatrician in the notes described it quite well, saying, "We're detectives piecing together a puzzle."
Yeah.
Symptoms must show before age 12 and significantly impact daily life across different environments, like home and school or work and home for adults.
A puzzle. That makes sense. It's not just ticking boxes. So what happens during a specialist assessment then? What should you actually expect?
Typically, it involves things like questionnaires. Parents and teachers often fill these out for kids.
Okay.
There'll be interviews, really digging into childhood development and current struggles. And sometimes computerized tests that look at attention and impulsivity.
Okay, got it. And there was a practical tip in there, too, for UK listeners.
Ah, yes, the right to choose scheme. It basically means if your local NHS waiting list for an assessment is longer than 18 weeks, you can request a referral to another approved provider, potentially speeding things up.
Good to know. And the advice is to come prepared, right? Bring school reports, specific examples of the challenges you're seeing.
Definitely. The more information the specialist has, the clearer the picture.
Okay, let's shift focus slightly to kids specifically. We know it affects school, but the material stresses it goes deeper, impacting social and emotional growth too. How does that play out?
Well, behaviorally and socially, kids with ADHD might, say, unintentionally dominate play dates. They might struggle with the back and forth of conversation, impulsive actions like grabbing a toy someone else is using or interrupting constantly during story time. Those things can obviously strain friendships.
Yeah, I can see that.
Common hurdles are things like difficulty waiting their turn, maybe overreacting to small disagreements, or just missing subtle social cues that other kids pick up on. There's another expert quoted, Dr. Sarah Ellis, a child psychologist. She emphasizes these behaviors stem from delayed emotional regulation, not rudeness.
That's so important. It's not intentional misbehavior.
Exactly. It's a developmental difference in managing those impulses and emotions.
And academically, what are common impacts there?
We touched on some losing track of multi-step instructions is a big one. misplacing things constantly like textbooks or homework, and just really struggling to start tasks that require sustained mental effort, even if they're capable.
Yeah, that initiation problem.
Right. And the sources warn that if it's not addressed, these ongoing difficulties can lead to real academic frustration and, worryingly, lower self-worth over time. But it's not all negative. The material also stresses that every challenge carries potential for growth.
How so?
With the right support, the right strategies tailored to them, these kids can develop incredible resilience. They often find really unique ways to solve problems because their brains work differently.
Mm-hmm.
It's about finding and nurturing those strengths.
Okay, so that's children, but what about adults? You mentioned it's often lifelong. Does ADHD just fade away, or does it change shape?
It definitely changes shape. That overt hyperactivity, like climbing furniture, that's rare in adults.
Right.
Instead, it often becomes more internal. That mental restlessness, we talked about thoughts racing during meetings, maybe needing to pace while on the phone, tapping feet constantly. Impulsivity might look different too. Less grabbing toys, more maybe interrupting conversations or making hasty decisions with money or careers. And it's really common for adults to get diagnosed much later in life. Sometimes it happens when their own kids are diagnosed and they suddenly recognize the same patterns in themselves.
A light bulb moment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Often it's because life just gets more complex, more demands at work, family responsibilities, and the coping strategies that kind of worked before just get overwhelmed.
So for adults navigating work, relationships, just daily life, what kind of practical strategies does the material suggest?
Well, for work in general organization, things like really leveraging technology, using digital reminders, calendars, alerts for everything, meetings, deadlines, even taking medication.
Externalizing that executive function.
Precisely. Breaking big, overwhelming tasks down into smaller chunks, like maybe using a timer for 20-minute focused work periods. And simple environmental tweaks can help enormously, requesting flexible hours if possible, or using noise-canceling headphones in an open office. And for relationships, communication is huge.
Also,
one expert, Dr. Raj Patel, suggests scheduling regular check-ins with partners, like a dedicated time each week just to talk about how things are going. Address any frustrations calmly before they build up. It adds structure.
That sounds really sensible. Proactive, not reactive.
Yeah, it seems less about fixing a problem and more about finding ways to work with your brain style. The sources mention many adults do well combining medication with coaching or therapy.
Yes, often a combination is very effective. And it's important to remember that seeking support isn't a sign of weakness. Even small adjustments can make a really big difference in feeling effective at work and connected in relationships.
Okay, so we've covered what it is, how it shows up, diagnosis. Let's talk about treatment and support. What help is actually available? The material emphasizes a combined approach is often best.
Right, it's rarely just one thing. The sources discuss medication and therapeutic approaches. Stimulant medications, like methylphenidate, are common. They work on neurotransmitters to help regulate attention and impulse control.
But especially for younger children, the recommendation is often to start with behavior therapy and parent training before even considering medication. Focus on skills and strategies first. There are also non-stimulant medications, which can be an option, sometimes also helping with things like sleep issues. Occasionally melatonin is used for that, but under supervision.
And therapy.
Talking therapies like CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, can be really helpful. They give practical tools for managing emotions, tackling procrastination, getting organized, and it's crucial to stress, treatment isn't one size fits all. Lots of people manage ADHD effectively without any medication at all, using just behavioral strategies and lifestyle adjustments. Another really powerful approach highlighted is building collaborative care networks.
What does that involve?
It means getting everyone involved in a person's life on the same page, like a team approach involving the GP, maybe a psychiatrist or psychologist, teachers or employers, perhaps an occupational therapist.
Yeah, so everyone's reinforcing the same strategies.
Exactly. It ensures support is consistent across different settings: home, school, work, healthcare. This kind of holistic model really helps build resilience and can also address other mental health needs, like anxiety, which often co-occur with ADHD.
Yeah, that integrated approach makes sense. It reinforces that even small, consistent changes, when applied across the board, can add up to significant improvements. So, wrapping this all up, what's the big picture here? We've seen ADHD is complex, it's neurodevelopmental, it's definitely not a character flaw. It really is about how an individual's brain is wired, isn't it? And that wiring brings both unique challenges, but also some pretty distinct strengths.
Absolutely. We've learned that understanding how it presents differently in different people, getting that diagnosis if needed, and using tailored, multifaceted support medication, therapy, coaching, lifestyle changes can make a massive difference day to day. For kids and adults, it really boils down to working with the brain's natural tendencies rather than constantly fighting against them.
Yeah, and our deep dive has really shown that with that awareness, with the right strategies, people with ADHD can absolutely thrive. They can manage the challenges and really lean into their natural creativity, their dynamic way of thinking. So for you listening, the key takeaway really is that knowledge gives you power. Power to act, whether it's for you, your child, someone you care about. Just understanding ADHD is the vital first step towards creating supportive environments where people can succeed.
And that actually brings up a bigger question, doesn't it? If we really start to embrace this idea of neurodivergence as cognitive diversity, well, how could that change things more fundamentally? How might our schools, our workplaces, our communities shift? Could they move beyond just trying to make everyone fit the same conventional mold and instead genuinely support and even celebrate all the different ways minds can work? It's definitely something to think about.
A really important thought to end on. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into ADHD. We really hope you feel more informed and empowered by what we've uncovered from the material.